Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is William Dewey, who reads from and discusses his new book, Without a Soul to Move, published by Lawrence and Gibson. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Just a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore on Colfax Avenue. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. And thank you for supporting independent bookstores, since many of you work here or worked here. That's good to know, too. Tonight is a special night for the staff of the Tattered Cover because we get to host one of our own. Former Tattered Cover staff member and Colorado native William Dewey will discuss his new novel, Without a Soul to Move, which was published by Lawrence and Gibson in New Zealand. It's set in Denver, and three men are trying with strange elegance to extract the meaning from their wilting lives. With graceful writing and an easy understanding of the humor and sadness of every day, Without a Soul to Move reveals the brilliant and complex shadows cast by the seemingly ordinary. The book debuted in New Zealand, where Will now lives, and in their press, Will describes the book as an attempt to find some useful outlet for the surge of emotions wreaked by the turbulence of his own life in the years leading up to its composition. Faced with the death of loved ones and self-imposed isolation in distant lands, writing a novel was the most constructive possible response he could come up with, and so he did. So please welcome William Dewey.
Thank you all for coming tonight. I left Denver in 2003, but it's always, I've been sort of the hub when I've gone off on my new adventures to different places. I've always come back here and launched the new things, the new adventures from here. And it, when I started working on this in 2004, I didn't really even consider where else it might take place. It just Denver was what I was thinking of when I started writing. So I do need to say thank you to all the people who have supported and encouraged it, especially to my brother Michael, my dad for my dad used to write stories for me way back at the beginning and encourage that. And I'm also grateful to Ravi and Matt and Ryan for the fertile creative grounds that you provided in the High House all those years ago. I'm going to read a chapter today from featuring one of the protagonists, Howie, and meeting the woman he loves at a park. Adrian and Howie at the park. On a scale of happiness, where one was the perfect soul-crushing suffering of a woman who has lost her entire family to a Holocaust, and 10 was the unadulterated bliss rarely achieved without the assistance of some narcotic or true love, Adrian Warner would probably have been sitting comfortable at about 8. She laughed much more frequently than she cried, and the closest she had come to catastrophe in her life so far was the flood in her parents' basement 6 years ago that had ruined roughly half her wardrobe and drowned her guinea pig, Owen. If she had to guess, Adrian would have put Maynard, her boyfriend, at 9, and Howie at 4. The suspicion that Maynard was an entire measure more happy than she was created a font of considerable guilt, because she was pretty sure their shared love was the primary reason for his 9, and sometimes she wished she could muster up the tiny bit of increased satisfaction it would take to bring equilibrium to their relationship. Part, no doubt, of her inability to match Maynard was a corresponding suspicion that Howie's 4 was caused by his unrequited love for her, which turned that font of guilt into a torrent. Since the root cause of her inability to requite Howie's love was her love for Maynard was indirectly a cause of her guilt concerning Howie's misery. And for feeling guilty about loving Maynard, her guilt concerning Maynard's happiness was compounded, so that keeping her contentment balanced directly at 8 demanded constant energy. It hadn't always been so difficult. When she first met Howie, she and Maynard had only been together for a few months. She had told Howie she had a boyfriend immediately after he asked her out, and at the time, such candidness seemed an adequate safeguard. Any greater precautions would have robbed her of a certain degree of autonomy. But in the intervening year and a half, as Maynard had shifted in her estimation from decent prospect to most wonderful boyfriend ever, Howie too had shifted from innocuous charmer to hopeless leech. No, she reflected, that wasn't fair. Howie was hopeless, at least in his love for her, but she could not dismiss him so easily. If he was still hanging around, it was as much due to her own refusal to shut him out as it was to his own clinginess. The truth was that she enjoyed spending time with him when he wasn't wretchedly avowing his insatiable love for her. When he could forget about the base physical attraction long enough to talk to her like she was a person and not a goddess, he could be engaging and funny. He could entertain her and he could make her think. And at those moments, when he was at his best, she loved being with Howie. But lately, for the past several weeks, he had not been at his best. He had been dejected, self-absorbed, and tiresome. And in the meantime, things kept getting better with Maynard, and their future kept looking brighter. To be around Howie then was like having a hangover thrust at you in the midst of a rollicking binge. Had he been like this when she first met him, after the Unnaturalist show at Herman's Hideaway in that bleak fall of 2001, she would have had no problem dismissing him from her life completely, as perhaps she should have when he first confessed his feelings to her last fall. By agreeing to continue spending time with him, even with the restated caveat that she was perfectly happy with Maynard and that no romance could ever come of it, she had given Howie tacit license to nurture his affection for her. Now that affection was fully developed, a foolish and awkward adolescent with no trace of the adorability it had commanded in its infancy, and she was ashamed of it. Ashamed, too, of the part she had played in its upbringing. If she had had this past year and a half to live over again, she would have aborted Howie's infatuation the moment it took seed. But to abandon it now wasn't merely a distasteful notion, it was literally unimaginable. When he called and asked if they could meet, she wouldn't even consider the possibility of telling him, nope, sorry, but would go along out of a sense of duty. The duty led her today to Washington Park, to a park bench beside a frozen lake, with Howie at her side. What was once a verdant, healthy place that brought to her life a certain contented calm was now barren and crusted with ice, and she was still here, hunched into a ball, hugging herself to keep warm and shivering. Howie exhaled sharply and coughed. You know where they're playing? They're playing the Bluebird. The Bluebird! Adrian did not have to ask whom Howie meant, because for the past hour he had been talking about nothing else. To some extent, she was relieved at how upset he was about the band, even as she suspected, somewhat egotistically, that his rift with Fisk was less a source of misery in and of itself, and more a consequence of the misery caused by his heartache over her. She was relieved because his obsessing over the band provided an excuse not to talk about the situation she felt she responsibly ought to be bringing up on her own. Fisk never got gigs at places like the Bluebird when I was in the band, Howie said. Never. Adrian forced her cold, stiff lips into a smile and patted Howie's hand. It's just a coincidence, Howie. It didn't happen because you left the band. But as soon as the words were out, she knew they were the wrong ones. I didn't leave the band, Howie whimpered. Fisk just replaced me. That was after you took off for 2 weeks, she pointed out. Nobody knew what had happened to you. We were worried. Fisk was too, I'm sure. Howie nodded. He pulled his hand out of the pocket of his peacoat long enough to wipe it beneath his nose. I'm sorry, Adrian. A few flakes of snow were making a tentative descent around them, and Adrian felt one brush past her cheek. She wiped at the spot where it had touched, and in a soft voice, she said, You don't have to apologize to me, Howie. Stuart's brother is only 19 years old, Howie said. 19! Adrian turned her gaze back toward the lake. What are you going to do, she asked. Do? I mean, how long are you going to stay at Johnny Rockets? Oh, I'm not really sure. Are you looking for another job? Howie shivered. In a small, weak voice, he told her, Don't worry about me. I'll be okay. Don't worry about you, she repeated. Worry was all she did about Howie anymore. While she might have given up on the prospect of ever seeing him as happy as he had been when they first met, she hoped at least to see him emotionally sound. His dismissive command not to worry, then, set off a spark against her smoldering resentment, and she reeled on him, her voice raising with each word spoken. You quit your job, Howie. You trashed your apartment. You just took off. I didn't know when I'd ever see you again. And now that you've finally resurfaced, you're working for minimum wage at a fucking hamburger joint? Where do you get off telling me not to worry? The warm sting of tears came to her eyes, and before she could rein them in, Howie was crying himself at the sight of them. I'm sorry, he said in a trembling voice. And, moved to pity, Adrian reached out to touch him. He put his arms around her waist, buried his face in her coat, and wept, saying repeatedly, I'm sorry, Adrian. I'm so sorry. She coaxed him to his feet and walked with him halfway around the lake to her car. He hugged her again after she opened his door, then dropped his arms and looked at the wet pavement. It's not minimum wage, though, he said so softly she had to cock her head towards him. She bent her knees slightly to try to look at Howie's hanging face, and he said, The base pay is $2.13 an hour, but mostly I'll be working for tips. It's a lot better than minimum wage. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on August 22nd, 2008.